Historic Fort Snelling stands perched above the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers, about 10 miles south of downtown Minneapolis on the west side of the Mississippi River. Today, when you visit, you can watch the soldiers drilling on the open parade within the reconstructed wall of the fort, dressed in 1820s uniforms and accompanied by fife and drum, as airplanes somewhat incongruously ascend overhead after taking off from the nearby airport. But when the 5th Infantry first arrived in 1819, they were here to build what was then the most remote outpost of the United States government to protect the lucrative business of the fur trade. When it was first built between 1820 and 1825, Fort Snelling was the heart of the European-American community in what became Minnesota. But statehood was still a long way off. The names of some of the early European-American residents of Minnesota are well known. Josiah Snelling, the fort's first commander and the man in charge of its construction. Henry Sibley, who ran the American Fur Company post at Mendota starting in the 1830s and who later became Minnesota's first governor. Most of the other early residents of the fort have been forgotten, at least in the public imagination, but there is one person in particular who was very well known in Minneapolis and St. Paul in the late 19th century and was also closely associated with Fort Snelling. She is unfamiliar to most Twin Cities residents today. Her name? Charlotte Wisconsin Clark Van Cleve. She and her husband General Horatio Van Cleve were then well-known members of the community, Horatio for his service as a colonel and then general in the Civil War, and Charlotte because of her childhood ties to Fort Snelling and her unstinting efforts to help the poor and downtrodden after the Civil War. But who was Charlotte that she became so well-known in the bustling young city of Minneapolis? The answer to that question takes us back to Fort Snelling's birth above the rivers.
Charlotte. Charlotte is one of my favorite people that we talk about at the fort.
Nancy Cass is a program manager at Historic Fort Snelling.
Charlotte arrived here very, very young. Her father was Nathan Clark.
She recounts the story of how Charlotte's parents, Nathan and Charlotte Clark, came out west with Lieutenant Colonel Henry Leavenworth and the 5th Infantry. They were sent to build the fort then known as Fort St. Anthony. The trip from the east just to Fort Crawford, now Prairie du Chien, in Wisconsin, was long and arduous, and things didn't get any easier for the Clarks or the 5th Infantry from there.
This was a very long trip, probably a good 3 months for them to come all this way. They get to Fort Crawford, which is down at Prairie du Chien, and Charlotte is born literally within about an hour after they arrived there. They discovered their supplies had gone bad, and Mrs. Clark was taken ill. From Charlotte's memoir, she mentions that her father stepped in and had to figure out how she was going to be fed at the time, so things were pretty precarious.
It was late in the season, and Colonel Leavenworth made the decision not to wait for new supplies to reach them at Fort Crawford. Instead, they made for St. Peter's at the junction of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers to establish the new fort. Of course, nothing had been built yet, so they lived on the boats at first while rough structures were built alongside the river. So Charlotte's life began with the fort, and her middle name, Wisconsin, was given to her by officers in the regiment in honor of their recent passage down the Wisconsin River to Prairie du Chien. Charlotte was sometimes called the daughter of the regiment, and she looked back on her early life on remote military posts with pleasure in her memoirs, 3 Score and 10, published in 1888. Today, we might well refer to her as an Army brat, and she was certainly proud of her connection to the military, and the challenges of her Army childhood, not to mention the strong will of her parents, helped to prepare her for difficulties she would face as an adult. Charlotte's memoirs recount many events at the fort and give us wonderful insight into what life was like at the early fort, especially for a child.
Perhaps the most distinct of my early remembrances is the arrival of the first steamboat. It had been
Charlotte was apparently a good storyteller and was always ready to tell the stories of her childhood at the fort. Besides appearing in her memoirs, some of her stories were also printed in local newspapers in the late 19th century. Her description of the arrival of the first steamboat at Fort Snelling when she was just 4 years old gives us a feeling for the excitement that this new, faster mode of transportation aroused in the residents of the fort.
I stand on tiptoe, but cannot see all I long to until Lieutenant David Hunter, my special favorite, catches me up and holds me on the balustrade. And now I clap my hands and almost cry with delight. For there she is, just landing, in all her pride and beauty, as if she felt herself the pioneer steamboat and knew she would become historic.
By the late 1800s, Charlotte was seen as a representative of that very early period in Minnesota history that seemed so distant by the turn of the 20th century. The Clarks left Fort Snelling in 1827 when Charlotte was about 8 years old. From then on, her life was full of the frequent moves familiar to any military family: Nashville, Tennessee, Smithfield, Kentucky, Cincinnati, Ohio, and Fort Winnebago in Wisconsin Territory. It was there in 1833, when she was about 14 years old, that Charlotte's life changed forever, and she met Lieutenant Horatio Phillips Van Cleve, then a 26-year-old adjutant at the post. The two became close very quickly, in spite of the difference in their ages, and in February 1834, Horatio wrote to his sister Margaret in New Haven, Connecticut.
My sisters have always been very dear to me, and they will always find a capacious and well-furnished room reserved for them in my heart, however it may be occupied by others. Within the past year, one has taken up a large set of apartments there, but she has not encroached upon yours in the least. Love her as you do me, if you wish to add to my happiness.
In spring of 1834, Charlotte was sent to Mrs. Apthorpe's school in New Haven, Connecticut. She returned to Fort Winnebago the following year, but her family was struck with tragedy when her father died in February 1836. Charlotte and Horatio married soon after, as Nathan Clark had wished, and Horatio soon resigned his commission. Over the next couple of decades, they moved around a lot, teaching school in Cincinnati, then going to Missouri, then back to Michigan, where they also taught in a school. Money was never plentiful, and they had a growing family. In 1856, they returned to Minnesota, this time to Long Prairie, for the so-called healthful climate after suffering from malaria in Michigan. They spent 5 years at Long Prairie farming and raising stock, struggling to make a life. But a great change was imminent for the Van Cleves and the country.
My dear mother, just look at the date of this and wonder as I do that I am sitting in Colonel Snelling's quarters, the veritable wife of the commanding officer.
The Van Cleves' difficult years at Long Prairie came to an abrupt end in 1861 when the Confederate guns fired on Fort Sumter. And after 25 years, Charlotte and Horatio were going back to Army life, even though their 12th child was imminent.
Charlotte, we know, was very, very patriotic. She mentions the flag frequently, even when she delivered one of her children living out in Long Prairie, and this would have been their last child that she was delivering, and she had the bed draped with the flag. She delivered her child the next morning. Her husband, Horatio Van Cleve, left Long Prairie and headed in here to Fort Snelling. So the call to duty was of utmost importance to her. She encouraged him to go.
Horatio was commissioned as the colonel in command of the 2nd Minnesota Volunteers and spent most of the war away from his family, while Charlotte took on the status and responsibilities of the wife of the commanding officer, a position that initially seemed unreal to her, and she described her feelings to her mother in a letter dated August 24, 1861.
All this makes me feel sometimes as if I were in the Arabian Nights. Last week, I was up to my elbows in work, making butter and cheese. Now, presto change, I am a lady. the wife of a commanding officer.
During the Civil War, Charlotte worked to alleviate the misery of the families of soldiers in her husband's regiment, some of whom had little money and little to eat. From their new home in the village of St. Anthony, Charlotte became involved in supporting the war effort, sometimes writing anonymous letters to the editor in response to criticism of her husband, letters which he fully approved of. In fact, the Civil War opened a new and important phase in Charlotte's life as she became more and more involved in the plight of the poor that she saw all around her. In this, she was not alone.
This is Jessica Toft, and I'm an associate professor at the School of Social Work at the University of St. Thomas and St. Catherine University. The Civil War really brought women into the forefront of helping the disadvantaged, the poor, the lame, and this was how women started to establish for themselves a professional sphere. They were initially motivated by probably religious influences, mostly with the social gospel and such, and this created in them an impulse to help the poor because they wanted to act like Christ on earth. They started to create the private sphere and push it into the public realm. And so we have this idea of municipal housekeeping and social motherhood. A countervailing force here is that we have the separate spheres ideology. So men are in the public realm of politics and work. They're the public face of the family. And women are the private face of the family, and so they are involved in domestic work, caring for children, raising children, and caring for their husbands. And in actuality, women's citizenship is really submerged.
But that didn't stop Charlotte. The country was changing, and so was Minneapolis. In 1860, the population of Minneapolis was only 3,000. By 1870, after the Civil War was over, Minneapolis had grown to 13,000, but by 1880, this bustling young industrial city had grown to 47,000 souls. Along with great opportunity came great need and many displaced and impoverished families. Middle and upper class women were now beginning to take steps to help the poor and the downtrodden and fight social evils like drunkenness.
In your issue of this morning appears an article entitled Women Crusaders, which gives an unfair and incorrect impression of my visit to the saloons in the East Division yesterday.
Charlotte wrote a letter to the Minneapolis Tribune in February 1874, taking exception to the paper's portrayal of her efforts the previous day to solicit donations to the Benevolent Society of Minneapolis. She described her reception by the saloon keepers, noting that all declined to donate except for a woman, the men all claiming that they couldn't afford it. She was unimpressed with their excuses.
I remarked that if the businesses they followed paid so poorly, it seemed unwise to continue it. With one exception, and that a young man whose moral sense had not developed as fully as his mustache, they all answered me politely and respectfully. I endeavored to convince them they were doing harm. God would not bless them with success in a business which brought misery to so many hearts and caused the lives of many who might, but for this dreadful temptation, become useful members of society.
It wasn't long after Charlotte's letter to the editor that she found her true calling, and in 1875 or 1876, Charlotte was one of a group of dedicated women who came together and founded a society first known as the Minneapolis branch of the Minnesota Magdalene Society. According to Abby Mendenhall, one of the founders, they soon realized that they needed to be an independent organization, and at the suggestion of Charlotte Van Cleve, they broke away from the parent society in St. Paul in 1876 and organized as the Sisterhood of Bethany. They opened Bethany Home, a place of refuge for young girls and women, that year. They found that their most important work was in helping these fallen or unfortunate young girls or women, the unwed mothers of the day. They filed papers of incorporation in 1879.
During this time, Tocqueville talked about America as being really a land of associations, a country of associations. If there's a problem, we're going to get a group together and we're going to try to solve it. And women really took this to heart because they didn't have the formal public ways that men had through government to address these things. So they did this sort of in more of a civil society sort of way, creating things like the Women's Christian Temperance Union and abolitionist movements, suffragist movements, anything that really addressed the well-being of families and social relationships, and especially mothers and children, they got involved in.
Four women were the heart of Bethany Home for more than two decades. Charlotte Van Cleve, president, Euphemia Overlock, vice president, Harriet Walker, wife of T.B. Walker of the Walker Arts Center, secretary, and Abby Mendenhall, treasurer. After Abby Mendenhall's death in 1900, Harriet Walker would write, "In the tremendous rush of the first growth of the city, where all things must be done at once, and where men have no thoughts save for material prosperity, it was well that the wives who came with these rushing men kept cool heads and laid deep and broad foundations for all charities and reforms." Mrs. Overlock was a widow, but General Van Cleve, Mr. Walker, and Mr. Mendenhall were all supportive of their wives' dedication, although it was the women who did the work. Horatio Van Cleve did rent their first house for them on 6th Street Southeast, but they soon moved to a new location on 17th Street, at that time almost outside the city limits. By 1885, they had moved again, and in 1891, they built a three-story addition as they continued to grow. The women who ran Bethany Home were motivated by their faith and their desire to reform and redeem the unfortunate or fallen girls and women they worked with. But that wasn't their only inspiration.
"Dear Madam, it is with pained heart I write to ask your advice concerning a poor, betrayed working girl. She is most heartbroken with grief."
The officers of Bethany Home frequently received pleas for help, both in letters and in person.
"And she was afraid she would be reproached with her shame in the future when she will try to live it down. Excuse my writing to you, but I thought your strong, clear advice was her only earthly hope. Hoping to hear from you soon, I am, dear madam, respectfully your friend, A. E. Thompson, Minneapolis, Minnesota, September 30th, 1878. Dear friend, the bearer of this, Loretta Boomhauer, is the young woman to whom I called."
Letters came from throughout the state and even neighboring states from a wide variety of men and women who wanted to help young girls who would otherwise be left alone, possibly without the support of even their families, and with very poor prospects for the future.
"I trust and believe that through your sympathy and kindness, you will enable her to make a new start in life and save her from the power of the destroyer of all that is fine and good. Truly your friend, W.C. Eustace, M.D., Farmington, December 15th, 1877.
The women who ran Bethany Home devoted endless hours to their cause. Besides the work of hiring a matron, raising money, and soliciting donations of supplies, they researched what was being done in other cities across the country. When traveling, they would visit similar institutions to see if they could learn something that might work better at Bethany Home. Through research and experience, they developed the rules of Bethany Home. These included requiring the girls to stay for a full year so they could establish principles and character that would make the girl strong enough to stand alone when she left. The girls were not locked in, so the inmates, as they were known, could easily walk out the door and leave. Abby Mendenhall wrote that that isn't how they usually did it, however. If they wanted to leave, they usually waited until night and then climbed out a window and over the back fence and walked to town. But this was rare. The girls were also advised to take an alias when they came to the home and not share their story with the other girls. When the year was over, a girl could then leave, dropping all connection with the others in the home, and start her new life. Thus there was a preponderance of Mary Browns and Jane Smiths and Emma Larsons. Mrs. Mendenhall said that this practice was a wise one and had been of untold benefit. Society at large was not very forgiving of missteps, and the girls bore the brunt of public shame and condemnation, a situation that roused Charlotte's indignation and sense of justice. Charlotte always spoke of them as my girls, and she spoke frequently and clearly about who she thought was to blame for their desperate circumstances.
"I cannot despise these poor creatures. I have for them the profoundest pity and a love for their precious immortal souls that overcomes all repugnance to them individually. And when I see their tears and hear their heartbroken plaints, I feel that they are more sinned against than sinning. Oh, friends, this is a fearful wrong, a sin against the laws of God and man, against decency, against all finer feelings of our nature. But is it not pitiful that to the sinful woman alone attaches all the odium, all the disgrace, the loathing, the punishment, and the ostracism? Where are the men that make them who they are? Oh, where are they not? Go find them in your business marts, in drawing rooms, side by side with pure young girls, in churches, at all places of entertainment and lawful recreation, cordially received and welcomed to the firesides of good women, who would avoid any contact with their sinning sisters, as they would the plague or leprosy. Charlotte Van Cleve, Annual Address, Sisterhood of Bethany, 1879.
So the idea that the girls were more sinned against than sinning, I think, goes back to women's piety. You know, the cult of true womanhood really has sort of four pillars to it: piety, purity, submissiveness, and domesticity. So I think that this really does go along with that kind of idea, at least the piety piece, that we all are sinners, but we all can be redeemed. And certainly the example of the American Female Reform Society starts to identify men as the culprits. That they say that men instigate all of these interactions between men and women, and that they are the sinners and the women were the sinned against. Now, there's a lot of other voices out there, but there are some women who are identifying that, and it sounds like Charlotte really sees this.
In 1877, Charlotte had the opportunity to help one of these young women who was perhaps more sinned against than sinning. But she was not facing pregnancy. She was facing the threat of hanging.
Will Seidel's death. He was assassinated last evening on Nicollet Avenue by Kate Noonan. This city was thrilled last evening with the report of a...
On February 16, 1877, Kate Noonan, a former servant girl of Charlotte's, shot the son of the president of a Minneapolis bank. It was big news, murder on Nicollet Avenue. At first, the newspapers presumed Kate's guilt, and there were few people who stood up for her, but Charlotte was one of them. Although the murder happened while Charlotte was out of town on a speaking trip, as soon as she returned home, she said to her husband, "Father, hitch up the horses and let us go to the jail and see Katie." And there they found Kate. According to Charlotte's account, she was crazed and in a vermin-infested cell. General and Mrs. Van Cleve visited Kate daily and got the authorities to clean up the jail. Kate had no money for a lawyer, so Charlotte tried to find her one. Finding no satisfaction in Minneapolis, she went to St. Paul and asked the county attorney, Christopher O'Brien, if he would take the case, although she couldn't pay him. He later said that this was the case that made his career. It was a difficult time. People began to draw their skirts away from Charlotte because of the notoriety of the case, but Charlotte was a staunch supporter.
"I went to court with Katie every day, and I testified for her. I told them about Katie's personality and how beloved she was in our household. And I told them about Will Seidel and how I'd seen plenty of his kind in my work at Bethany Home. I told them the world was better for the death of such a man as Will Seidel, although I deplore that Katie had been the instrument of his passing."
At first, the newspapers sang the praises of Will Seidel, a fine young man with a great future ahead of him, snatched away by Kate Noonan, a mere servant girl who was no better than she should be. It wasn't until the trial in June of 1877 that evidence began to emerge that perhaps Will Seidel hadn't been such a paragon after all. According to Kate's testimony, Will had pursued her at dances that servant girls attended. She described their first drink together.
"Once, when I was passing the Variety Theater, he came out and said, 'You are my oyster.' I drank with him there and became dizzy, and the next thing I knew, I was in bed in his room at Dayton's Block."
The local newspapers had a field day.
"Emotional insanity. Responsible or irresponsible, sound or unsound mind."
In the first trial, Kate's lawyers argued that she had been insane at the time of the shooting. Testimony at the trial showed that Will had continued to see Kate, even renting a room for her and telling her he loved her and he would always take care of her. When he got engaged to another young woman, a woman of his social status, he dumped her, telling her he wanted nothing more to do with her. The police chief even tried to buy her off for a pittance on Will's behalf, but Kate wanted at least enough money to be able to go away and start fresh somewhere else, away from all the talk. The testimony presented persuaded many people, including men on the jury, and the first trial ended with a hung jury, 11-1 in favor of acquittal on the grounds of insanity. Kate spent the next 6 months in jail with Charlotte's constant support and was retried in December. This time, a new witness was found who had just returned to the state and who claimed to have seen Will put something in Kate's drink at that first assignation in 1874. This time, Kate was acquitted on the grounds of emotional insanity. Eric Janis, Dean of William Mitchell College of Law, has specialized in mental health law.
Although in the popular imagination, criminals are always claiming insanity and getting off, in actuality, it's a very rare event that in a contested case, a defense of insanity would be successful. So this historic example is a very interesting one.
Along with helping her girls at Bethany Home, Charlotte was determined to help Kate build a new life. Charlotte arranged for Kate to learn to be a seamstress and persuaded her friends to use Kate's services. Not only that, she gave Kate a home in her own house. Kate became quite successful and was closely tied to the Van Cleve family for the rest of her life. She was even able to put her brother Frank through law school. Over the next 2 decades, Charlotte continued to work tirelessly for Bethany Home. It continued on all the way up to about World War II. Despite her strong advocacy for sometimes unpopular causes, Charlotte was well-loved and respected in the community. In 1905, a very elderly Charlotte Van Cleve was feted at the 100th anniversary of the cession of the land that made up the military reservation at Fort Snelling. She made the trip to the fort in an automobile, a far cry from the keelboats that had brought the 5th Infantry in 1819. Charlotte passed away on April 1, 1907. The local newspaper ran an extensive and glowing obituary that recognized both her early ties to Fort Snelling and her hard work to improve the lives of the poor and unfortunate that she saw around her.
Without neglecting the duties of wife and motherhood, Mrs. Van Cleve was always a sturdy champion of the right of woman and a warm advocate of its right to equality before the law and to the ballot. Injustice of any sort never failed to rouse her spirit to the point of seeking redress for the injured. Among all the many forms of social injustice, none roused her indignation more than the relentless punishment meted out by society to the fallen woman. Into this fight she threw herself single-handed and did not fear to visit, alone, the haunts of vice and crime on her mission of reformation and redemption. Minneapolis Tribune, April 2, 1907.
But perhaps most of all, Charlotte relished her role as mother. To her children, her nieces and nephews, her grandchildren, and her girls. After her death, the iceman who delivered to the Van Cleve house commented to Harriet Van Cleve, "I shall miss that white-haired old lady from the window. She always looked to me just like a mother ought to look." This is Bobby Scott for KFAI. Thanks to Sabrina Cruz, Lisa Day, Ron Grog, Christine and Jeff Norden, and the historic Fort Snelling Fife and Drum Corps.
Miniculture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.